For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, a bouquet for viewers in Regina, Saskatchewan, number 37 on our list of top views by city, and a brickbat for the people in Quebec, the province, who apparently want lots of energy as long as it doesn't come from some stinking power plant. Like G.K. Chesterton's quote, cultivated cockney, who said he likes milk out of a clean shop and not a dirty cow, end quote, they evidently don't even want a company to develop a large graphite deposit in the Laurentians region, which would help support the electric vehicle industry, because of, quote, the potential harm to the environment, end quote, and because, quote, the Pentagon is involved in the project, end quote. So, they want to be defended, just not by anyone, certainly not themselves, and they want to have power fall from the sky. No gas or oil pipeline, no fracking for natural gas in La Belle Provence, and no nuclear plants. So, turn off your power? Mais jamais de la vie! It is true that Quebec has been blessed with a sort of geography that allows a lot of hydropower, and it has exploited it, actually creating an energy glut at one point that made them, among other things, just about the world's leading per capita consumers of backyard swimming pools. But they've pretty much taken all the good sites, and a power shortage looms. Unfortunately, there's no fantasy shortage, either among citizens or among politicians. And speaking of fantasy, we know you all cannot wait for COP29. It will be historic, like all such gatherings. But fear not. As this week's newsletter was being written, all eyes were currently not on Bonn, Germany, or a preliminary meeting, blah, 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 blah. In fundraising to cover this non-event, Climate Home News wrote, quote, the mid-year climate talks in Bonn are a key event for policymakers, researchers, and NGOs working to move climate action forward, but one that gets little attention from the world's media, end quote. Yeah? Maybe that's because nothing important ever even happens at the COP conferences, let alone at these intervening gabfests that lay the ground for the expensive high-profile failure to come. But of course, you can say just anything on climate, including Canary Media intoning via email that, quote, there's no room for fossil fuels in a carbon-free world, end quote. A carbon-free world? We're going to punch a hole in the periodic table? We'll have a world with no CO2 in it, no complex carbohydrates, no diamonds, no living things? Shades of Greenpeace deciding chlorine was the devil's element and must be banned, apparently unaware that, for instance, the oceans are salty mostly because of, sodium chloride. Also from that file, Canada's Minister of Environment and Climate Change X's out, quote, building climate-resilient communities is more important now than ever before as extreme weather events increase in frequency and intensity, end quote. And mainstream journalists never even ask him which events he thinks have increased, let alone why he thinks it. It's just rant, rinse, and repeat. Oh, and remember planned obsolescence? That particular conspiracy theory wasn't really built to last, but back in the 1960s and 1970s, a lot of people thought that corporations engaged in cutthroat competition deliberately created wearing out so that you'd have to buy more of their products. The fact that so-called cutthroat competition actually strongly incentivized companies to produce better and longer-lasting products eluded these deep thinkers, as did the option of taking advantage of this corporate malpractice by creating lasting products themselves and getting rich while making people happy. But now, the Atlantic Weekly Planet bolts the thing back together, at least temporarily, saying, quote, EVs could last nearly forever if car companies let them, end quote. Those dastardly scheming capitalists again. Oh, and from the Nature Red and Tooth and Ballot files, Euronews whinges, quote, pigeon problems. Germantown votes to have birds killed, outraging animal rights activists, end quote. But look, if we're going to live with nature, it has to meet us halfway, which is a lesson climate alarmists might also learn, especially if journalists didn't treat critics say as a trump card over voters say. And speaking of voters, Inside Climate News crows, quote, Mexico elected a climate scientist, end quote. And in fact, Claudia Sheinbaum does have a PhD in environmental engineering. But then the piece immediately frets, quote, but will she be a climate president, end quote, because, inexplicably, she, quote, remains committed to oil and gas, end quote. And then, for an unbiased look at the matter, quote, which side of her is going to win, said Claudia Campero, a longtime environmental activist in Mexico City. It's still up in the air, end quote. Right. Will she turn off the power and sink Mexico's struggling efforts to lift its people out of poverty in pursuit of polite progressive applause? Or will she care how people live or even whether they do? Stay tuned. Hey there. If you're one of the 40% of our viewers who aren't yet subscribed, please click this button and do it. Get us to 100,000. Thanks very much for watching, and back to me. And oh joy! Just in time for summer, we were offered, quote, a new way to talk about heat, end quote. The New York Times piece kicks off with, quote, last month was not only the hottest May on record, it was the 12th month in a row to earn such a distinction. But was it stickier, end quote? Beats us. Because where we live, it was so chilly that we had extra blankets on the bed in mid-June as nighttime lows got down into single digits. That's Celsius, I hasten to add. But if the ordinary kind of heat doesn't show up, scientists can simply invent a new kind that only their computers can detect. As for new ways to talk about heat, people have been complaining about the weather since the invention of speech. But now, the Times piece welcomed this new and unfamiliar piece of terminology, one that nobody seems to have thought they needed until now, because, quote, as climate scientists, meteorologists, and public health officials grapple with record-breaking temperatures, they're also exploring new ways of measuring extreme heat and new ways of communicating its risks, end quote. Which is necessary because, apparently, nobody knew that heat was both unpleasant and dangerous until some journalist said some scientist said it using a neologism. Phooey. And another part of the climate debate that's highly unrealistic is, well, there are a lot of them. But one is these modeling scenarios that do both climate and the economy, including the infamous zombie RCP 8.5 scenario. And they suffer from one particular defect that we'd like to zero in on here. They try to model policy and its impacts. The trouble with which is that policy in democratic countries is very changeable, depending on how citizens view the impact of climate change and also of climate change policies. To suggest that policy and responses to policy can be modeled decades out using linear algebra is fatuous. For instance, there's this famous backlash going on now because energy costs are skyrocketing and industry is collapsing while the weather is not actually getting worse. And that means that emissions are likely to rise more than they would if, let's say, solar and wind suddenly flooded the market with affordable energy while firestorms swept through every third neighborhood with a label saying, made in CO2. So, put that in your model and run it. Or, rather, don't. In our view, both the climate and the economy are what is technically called transcomputable. That means that they're far too complex because of intricate interlinked feedback mechanisms to submit to some Isaac Asimov fantasy out of the 1950s about a mathematically rigorous psychohistory. And certainly you'd look a bit of a fool trying to program a computer to predict late 19th century American populism, or the 1930s New Deal, or see World War I coming, or any number of other things. Including, just as one example, what if Germany had won the Great War in October 1914 as it nearly did? How would that have affected the economy in the 1970s? It's ridiculous even to try to put that into a computer. And even on a less cosmic scale, it's still hopeless. The effort to predict what climate policy will be like over the next 30 years politically and economically is for chumps even without then trying to figure out what that policy will do to the weather and what the weather will then do to policy. Consider that the elections for the European Parliament from June 6th to 9th famously just returned a lot of right-wing and far-right members. No far-left ones, of course. Who saw that coming? And who, even now that it's happened, can predict what impact it will have on European energy policy a year from now, let alone a decade or a quarter century? The thing is, running wild guesses through a computer doesn't make them more authoritative. It just makes you look more clueless than if you'd simply used tea leaves or a crystal ball and been honest about it. Oh, and in this week's newsletter, Parker Gallant alerts us to a final report from the Canadian Electricity Advisory Council, wherein, quote, to understand the impact of the transition on affordability for Canadians, the changes to their energy wallets, the Council collaborated with the Transition Accelerator, an energy think tank, to conduct a nuanced and data-driven analysis, end quote. nuanced, no less, and data-driven, not politics-driven. Heavens no. Though, of course, quote, the modeling indicated that 7 in 10 Canadian households would see net savings, while 3 in 10 would see net cost increases. On the whole, Canadians could expect to save $15 billion in total energy-related costs, despite a doubling of the rate of electricity sector investment, end quote. Whee! Free money! And only a curmudgeon would point out that this body is very obviously part of the government trying to force this transition down our throats, no matter how we try to squawk about affordability. Oh, and good luck finding out how much money the government is giving it to say that they're right about everything and wise and kind besides. Fortunately, I'm a curmudgeon. Ah, and in the newsletter, we also continue our examination of Professor Qingbin Liu's remarkable challenge to global warming orthodoxy, his CRE model of climate change, and particularly his 6 key observations that show that halo GHGs, rather than CO2, dominate climate change. This week, it's the second item on his list, 21st century temperature patterns in the troposphere and stratosphere. As you know, real science proceeds by testing hypotheses against data. And here, hypothesis 1, the orthodox one, predicts via its cherished computer models that, as CO2 levels in the atmosphere rise, the surface of the planet and the troposphere should warm, but above that, the stratosphere should cool at all latitudes from the tropics to the poles. It's the same as if you added insulation to the walls of your house. At least if the insulation's any good, what would happen is that the inside would get warmer, but then, with less heat loss, the air around your house should get cooler. By contrast, as Liu has previously shown, as halo GHG levels drop and ozone levels rebuild, the stratosphere should warm, especially in the polar regions. And, inconveniently for the CO2 theory, the stratosphere stopped cooling around 20 years ago, and even the IPCC admits that it now appears to be warming. Again, we want to be cautious here. Granted, it's only 20 years of data. But on the other hand, because it coincides with a large increase in CO2 levels, the contrasted outcomes is very interesting. Now the question is, does anyone inside the fortress of orthodoxy care? And the answer is, very possibly not. Roger Pilkey Jr. has written many times about the grossly exaggerated emission scenarios used by climate modelers to justify scary global warming studies, especially the dreaded RCP 8.5. Despite it and its scurvy companions being clearly unrealistic, climate modelers and authors of so-called impact studies just kept using 8.5, like an addict who can't quit the drug that once brought pleasure and now just keeps them from collapsing. But over the past year, Pilkey Jr. wrote several articles expressing a cautious hope that modelers were beginning to detox and get sober now that scenario analysts have decisively shown the implausibility of RCP 8.5 and its cousins. Alas, he underestimated the grip of the alarmist drug. And so, in a new Substack post, he discusses a recent report from the IPCC modeling group, which rejects scientific advice to quit the high emissions fix, and instead declares it's checking out of rehab and has, quote, chosen, again, to assign the most extreme scenario its highest priority, end quote. And, like an addict, climate science is not to be trusted when off the wagon. Finally, from the CO2science.org archive, we look at a paper on atmospheric CO2 concentration from AD 800 to 2000, based on fossil Tsuga heterophylla needles from Washington State, which suggests that, in fact, both temperature and CO2 peaked around AD 1000, again in the early 1300s, and then in the latter half of the 20th century. But if the hockey stick is right about temperature, it's wrong about CO2 because it awkwardly decouples increasing warmth from rising CO2. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I'm not counting on megawatts from heaven. That's right.